Curious City is supported by the Poetry Foundation, with a reminder that Chicago is the pulse of poetry. Visit the Poetry Foundation on the corner of Superior and Dearborn to explore their library of 40,000 books, attend public events, and view Frente a la Vida, Facing Life, a striking multidisciplinary art exhibition by Chicago artist Victoria Martinez. Learn more at poetryfoundation.org.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is Curious City. So last episode, we tried to answer this near impossible question: what is the most consequential year in Chicago history? We talked to a few local historians who somewhat reluctantly landed on 1 year. Reluctantly, because history doesn't just happen in 1 year. Alas, they all mentioned 1919. Among other things, this is the year of the Chicago race riot, which had a big impact on how the city segregates itself today. But our historians had a whole bunch of years that were big for Chicago. So today, we're going to slice it from a few other angles. Like, what was the most consequential year from the perspective of civil rights, women's rights, or arts and culture? And FYI, at the risk of this feeling a little all over the place, we're leaning into the fact that time is not actually linear. So strap in and come along for the ride. Let's start with 1966, which was an important year for civil rights. Here's Peter Alter, historian with the Chicago History Museum.
This is when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. brought the civil rights movement north. He was invited by a CPS teacher, Al Raby. They invited Dr. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to Chicago to start the Chicago Freedom Movement. And so there is an immense amount of sort of civil rights focus on Chicago, especially in the summer of 1966.
Dr. King briefly lived on the West Side at 1550 South Hamlin in North Lawndale. In August of that year, he led a march on the South Side protesting housing segregation.
He was hit in the head by a brick or a rock or something in Marquette Park. And he said, you know, the resistance I'm seeing to myself personally, my movement, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and the broader civil rights movement, you know, is just as bad or worse than what I've seen in the South.
Wow.
This is a terrible thing. I've been in many demonstrations all across the South, but I can say that I have never seen, even in Mississippi and Alabama, mobs as hostile and as hate-filled as I've seen in Chicago.
Peter Alter said the civil rights movement was already alive and well in Chicago by this point. But the arrival of Dr. King brought so much more attention to it here.
Now is the time to have a confrontation in the city of Chicago between the forces resisting change and the forces demanding change. Now is the time.
And his work during this time laid the groundwork for what would become the U.S. Fair Housing Act.
Let justice roll down from City Hall like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Now is the time.
So what about important years in the women's history of Chicago? For this, I spoke to a historian at the University of Illinois Chicago, Jennifer Breyer. She takes us to 1889.
The Hull House settlement opens in 1889. It's started by three women, Jane Addams, Ellen Gates Starr, and Mary Rose Smith.
The Hull House was an experimental community that served Chicago's suddenly massive population.
In 1889, Chicago is the fastest growing city in the world. And it's the fastest growing city in the world because it is a crossroads. It is a place where immigrants are coming, a place of incredible industrialization, the incredible confluence of these two things, immigration and industrialization, materialize in very harsh forms for people without means living in the city, building the city, making the city what it is.
It was less than 20 years after the Great Fire, and Breyer says living conditions in Chicago were not great.
There's just not a kind of infrastructure to care for people properly. And that's what Jane Addams intervenes in. So within about, I think, like 15 or 20 years, it is just a huge settlement. It's 13 buildings. It has a kindergarten. It has a playground. It's a place where people who come from means, like Jane Addams and Ellen Gates Starr and Mary Rose Smith, are able to live with people who are living in poverty, people who are immigrants, people who are basically not provided for by the city of Chicago or the businesses of Chicago or any of these things.
Mm-hmm. The Hull House offered legal aid, childcare, language classes. It became a model for other settlement houses in the U.S. It was basically a beacon of social reform. Breyer also pointed us to another impactful year, 1969.
So there's another Jane. Maybe that's the theme of part of this.
In 1969, a group of women in Chicago created the Jane Collective.
It's a group of young women, probably pretty close in age to Jane Addams, right? So they're in their 20s. And they experience the inability to get safe abortions in 1965 when they're in college, 1966, 1967. In 1969, they organized together to create this abortion referral service. They're trained by a gynecologist who trains them how to do abortions.
Breyer says the Jane Collective performed over 10,000 abortions between 1969 and 1972.
And it is a testament for me to really thinking about what a group of young women who are committed to a kind of alternative reality in the face of the state telling them that they can't do something, to figuring out how to do something.
Yeah.
And so for me, when I was thinking about going from Jane Addams to the Jane Collective, there is something really poignant about that. Mm. And they are both of Chicago.
What would you say it was about Chicago that made Jane Addams, her work and the work of her colleagues, and also the Jane Collective come about?
I mean, there's something about being in a city, in both cases, at least at the start, both for white, largely middle class women, there is something about the freedom of the city for them that I think is important. I think it's also important to understand that they are coming out of an educational environment where they, Jane Addams is among the some of the first women to be college educated. She's in that early generation, and these women are obviously in a later generation. But I think that there's something about Chicago being a place where that kind of possibility exists. I think there is a anonymity here. I think there's also a legacy of feminism, even before the phrase exists, where there is a sense that women should be equal participants in the urban environment. And it's not so simple, and it doesn't ever work linearly.
Breyer makes the point that for all their great work, both of these organizations mostly focused on serving white people in Chicago.
There's no doubt that racism is part of all of these stories. The way that Hull House did and did not engage communities of color, particularly African-American migrants who are coming during the first Great Migration, and then a little bit later, Mexican migrants who are coming through the Bracero program and other earlier programs. And then the Jane Collective was about abortion care, and it wasn't about necessarily about what we would today call reproductive justice. It didn't necessarily deal with the illegal sterilization of women of color and what it meant to be able to have children when you wanted to have them.
Yeah.
So it's a complicated story, but still an incredibly important, for me, an incredibly important year in the women's history of Chicago.
Mm-hmm. In 1904, the Pekin Theater opened.
Now let's get into a consequential time for arts and culture in Chicago. Culture writer Ariane Nettles pointed to 2 years in particular.
Now, the Pekin is really significant because it opened as the first Black-owned vaudeville theater in the U.S. that had its own stock company, right? Like how you might be a part of the Joffrey Ballet Company, right?
Yes.
And so as the culture on the south side of Chicago really grew, this kind of stretch along State Street became really important, and it was called the Stroll. And all up and down the Stroll, we had theaters like Pekin. So again, we're talking about 1904. This is really the time period of a lot of like blackface. When we talk about blackface, this is the blackface time, right?
Okay.
And so you had Black people able to really decide what that variety act was going to look like. Mm. What was this entertainment going to be? It was a way for people to say, no, yeah, you can laugh with us, but like, I'm not going to let you laugh at us, right? And so this theater was just kind of like a really important jumping off point for a lot of the stage work and later film that we would see that really burst onto the scene here in Chicago.
Nettles also brought up 1924, when some of the first electrical music recordings ever were made right here in Chicago. She said this marked a big shift away from the more mechanical and acoustic recordings of the past.
Why was it that year when it really took off?
Yeah. So if you are an aspiring, let's say you're an aspiring blues man and you live in Mississippi, you want to come to Chicago to record your music to then be distributed, right? And so when we talk about an industry, a burgeoning music industry, it was really like the release of the music that kind of became really significant in our history. And so when we talk about like how Chicago was the epicenter or is the epicenter of urban blues, right? Of jazz, you know, and then later things that kind of stemmed from those sounds like house and rock and roll and all that type of stuff. Well, it was really because this was the place that people came to record music of all genres. Like, it was a strong thing. And so we just really have this kind of ecosystem of an entertainment industry that just really grew from being able to be a place where people would come to record and perform.
There are so many other years our historians mentioned that we don't have time to get into today, including Chicago's greatest hits years, like 1871 and 1893. You know, the years of the Great Chicago Fire and the Chicago World's Fair. Sherman Dilla Thomas also mentioned 1963. That's when about 250,000 CPS students skipped class during the one-day Chicago school boycott. This was a movement against segregation and inequality in schools.
I think this is one of the most wonderful demonstrations and stabs for freedom that the Negro in Chicago has ever had.
Ariane Nettles mentioned 1940. That was the year of the Negro Exposition, a showcase of Black art and innovation.
The Negro Exposition was basically a world's fair, but for Black folks.
She says this led to the Southside Community Art Center and the DuSable Black History Museum.
After all of this great stuff was preserved, we see the emergence of Chicago institutions that are really important to us today.
And Jennifer Breyer pointed us to 1851, when Chicago passed a stringent anti-cross-dressing law. And the penalty for breaking it was a fine of between $20 and $100.
That's, first of all, a huge amount of money in 1851.
Yeah.
But I think the more important thing is that if you imagine why an ordinance would be passed, it means that there were lots of people appearing in clothing not belonging to their sex.
Marginalized groups in Chicago were prosecuted under this ordinance until 1973. That's over a century. So as we look ahead to this new year we're in, 2025, another potentially consequential year for Chicago, I noticed that many of these same issues of the past are still on the table. From reproductive rights to immigrant rights, racial justice, political change, access to housing, and access to capital. And in hopes of finding a proper conclusion to this week's most difficult of questions, I asked Jennifer Breyer where Chicago is positioned right now in the context of all these issues. Big question.
Yeah, it's a big question. You know, part of what I was reflecting on, just even in listening to you ask the question, is how many possibilities were in the past that do not seem to be at front of mind right now. And I think that sometimes we think that things get better. You know, there's sort of a progress narrative that things are just getting better and better and better. And I say this to my students sometimes, particularly about LGBTQ history. Things in the past may not have been as bad as you think. There may have been something more possible in the past that we have lost track of. And we may need to look to those past markers and remind ourselves that we may not be where we thought we were. And we need to look to the past to find some other possibilities for what we might want to imagine for our futures.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Justin Bull produces Curious City, along with me and AC Valdez. Mary Hall is our digital producer. Susie Ahn is our editor. Curious City is a production of WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. If you have questions about Chicago and the region, send them our way at curiouscity@wbez.org or visit us at wbez.org/curiouscity. I'm your host, Erin Allen. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next week.
Rise and shy. WBEZ is serving local stories for breakfast every weekday morning from 5 to 11. Tune in on the WBEZ app to hear what Chicago's talking about as you start your day.